This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Right now, in Bonn, Germany, Afghan factions are meeting to begin the arduous process of building a new Afghanistan after the Taliban. With the support of U.S. bombers, the Northern Alliance is now in Kabul and on a roll. The Pashtuns, the southern seedbed of the Taliban and Afghanistan's traditional rulers, are on the outs. Peace depends on power sharing, but will they? In this hour, a closer look at the passions and political clout of the Pashtun in the creation of a new Afghanistan. First, important developments at the Afghan conference in Bonn. Tom Hennigan covers Afghanistan for Reuters and is in Germany. I asked him what happened today and about the prospects for power sharing in a new Afghanistan.
The prospects are a lot better than they were even a day or so ago. The Northern Alliance came here with the problem that everybody else, the three exile groups that are at the table with them, were deeply suspicious of their motives. They didn't believe that the alliance wanted to share power.
Mm-hmm.
But over the past 24 hours, they've made it very clear in several steps that they're actually willing to share power with the others and ready to go ahead and try to move onto a democratic process.
What's bringing them around, Tom Hennigan?
I think they want to go that way. I think they want to form a democratic political system in Afghanistan, which has never known that before. They're tired of this warlordism, they're tired of the factionalism, and they think that if they can use this opportunity to start to set up a democratic system, the country will be better, and they, as are a talented group of people, and they would profit from it.
Almost no one to date has given the Northern Alliance this kind of credit to say that they would stand up themselves and voluntarily move to power sharing and envision this democratic government. Is this a surprise to the diplomats watching the meetings?
It's a surprise to a lot of the diplomats that don't know anything about Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
What has happened over the past few years in Afghanistan is that the Jamiat Islami, the party of Ahmad Shah Massoud, the commander who was killed mm-hmm. in September, and also of Rabbani, the president now, has undergone a transformation. There's a younger generation that's come up, like the Interior Minister, Yunus Kanuni, who is here leading the delegation, mm-hmm. like Abdullah, the foreign minister, and also Mohammed Fahim, the defense minister, who are much more flexible, much more modern-minded, and they want to see this transformation. This is what Massoud wanted to do, too. He learned his lessons from the mistake of the chaotic period from 92 to 96 when Rabbani was the head of the government and he was defense minister.
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't give him credit for that. That's what's coming out now.
It's a great turn of events. How is this move being encouraged by the United States and the West? What are they promising or threatening?
They're holding out the prospect of huge reconstruction aid if a government is set up now and normal conditions are restored in Afghanistan. I don't know the figures, but it's such a big offer that all of them know that they have to come up to an agreement now.
And what about the Pashtuns? How well represented are they, and do they appear to be on board with this movement?
I heard somebody say the other day that about half of the delegates here were Pashtun. They're not represented as one group, but they're in all the groups. All the groups have Pashtuns, all the groups have Persian speakers, most of the groups have Hazaras,
mm-hmm.
Shiites, and so it's a mix. And the Pashtun issue is actually one that the Pakistanis make more of than the Afghans themselves.
Hmm.
That's a bit of manipulation from the outside.
What about openness to a UN role in so-called nation building or multinational troops? What's been said on that front?
That was another sticking point that cleared up today. The exiles want to have multinational force, mostly because they fear that the Northern Alliance would misuse its power in Kabul if they went there. But the Northern Alliance made very clear today they have no problem with a multinational force to assure security. So we could see, within a few weeks, we could see foreign troops coming in there. They said they have a preference for troops from Muslim countries, of course.
Mm-hmm. Tom Hennigan, you've spent a lot of time in Afghanistan. What could make this all fall apart?
It could fall apart if you had manipulation from the outside, like from Pakistan and Iran, mm-hmm. because they've played their own favorites for a long time, both during the jihad, the war against the Soviet Union,
mm-hmm.
and most egregiously, the Pakistani support for the Taliban, such full support for the Taliban. Both Pakistan and Iran are taking a back seat now, so you don't have that factor. The other thing that could make it fall apart, but actually doesn't look that likely, is that there are warlords inside who were used as the agents of this manipulation, the biggest one being Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. Mm-hmm. But he's very powerless now. He's the one who fought against Massoud and Rabbani in the 1990s and ended up trashing half of Kabul, literally destroying half of the city in the civil war. So it's looking very optimistic, because the factors that made it break down in the 1990s don't seem to be there. Because you can never tell with Afghanistan. I have to add that right away, that anything can fall apart. Anybody can turn coat in Afghanistan at a moment's notice.
So if things stay on track, what are the next steps? What should we look forward to?
The next thing they'll do is they're supposed to all meet again in Kabul and work out the details of this interim parliament that they want to set up and the interim cabinet that they want named. And then this interim administration should work for about 2 years. During that time, they would draft a new constitution, a more democratic constitution than they had before, and also organize free elections. So at the end of the two-year period, the constitution would be adopted and the elections would be held. And from then on, there would be normal democratic system, they hope.
And as of today, it looks like it could happen.
Surprising but true. Again, I say you never know what to expect from the Afghans, but it was a very good day today.
Tom Hennigan is a senior political correspondent for Reuters. He spoke to us from Bonn. The Pashtun have a saying, me against my brother and me against our cousins, we and our cousins against the enemy. Violence in Pashtun society is as central as the long-held belief that they are the rightful rulers of Afghanistan. With religious fervor and AK-47s, the Pashtun formed the backbone of the Taliban. Now what? The Taliban is near collapse, but the Pashtun remain. Where do they and a new Afghanistan go from here? Can the Northern Alliance and the Pashtun hold hands and build a new nation together? Are you optimistic that international efforts will lead to the creation of a viable, cohesive country in Afghanistan? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from London is Isabel Hilton. She's an acclaimed foreign correspondent for radio, TV, and print, has recently returned from Pakistan. Her article, The Pashtun Code, is featured in this week's New Yorker magazine. Good evening, Isabel Hilton.
Good evening.
And with us from Vermont is Special Coverage's news analyst, Jack Beattie. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Isabel Hilton, we read your New Yorker article with great interest. You've been in Pakistan, all up and down the Pashtun area there. And now today, you've just heard along with us Tom Hennigan's report from Bonn. He sounds optimistic. Are you? Do you think there's a chance here for a viable, inclusive government in Afghanistan?
Well, yes, I think there's a chance. But like Tom, I think I would enter a note of caution because it's still a very volatile situation. Mm-hmm. I agree that a lot of the trouble in the past was from external interference, but I think that we're not entirely free of that yet. Although that there are Pashtun in all the delegations, and the Pashtun are particularly attached to the king as a symbolic figure, mm-hmm. and a figure who could unite Afghanistan. Again, just playing a symbolic role, not a return of the monarchy. Mm-hmm. But there is very little representation in Rome of the people who are seizing territory in the south of Afghanistan at the moment. Mm-hmm. And those are people...
The Pashtun people.
The Pashtun people, absolutely. This is their territory. This mm-hmm. is their heartland. Mm-hmm. Some of them were Mujahideen. They fought the holy war against the Russians. Most of them were anti-Taliban. They went into exile when the Taliban took power and, have been living all over the place. In the last 5 or 6 weeks, mm-hmm. they've returned first to Peshawar and then into Afghanistan. The group, for instance, who are running Jalalabad mm-hmm. Is composed largely of people like that. There, many of the people who were trying to negotiate in Kandahar with the Taliban, with that sort of leader. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons they're seizing territory is with a view to what comes after, because they could see themselves being locked out of the process. Once the Northern Alliance got into Kabul, they became extremely alarmed. And so they took territory as a bargaining counter. And unless they're satisfied with the way things progress, then effectively you have two Afghanistans. You have a north-south split there. That's going to take quite a lot of delicate handling, and it's a very quarrelsome situation. There isn't one leadership there, for instance.
We spoke with your countryman, Robert Fisk, the other night, and he was saying he expects civil war. The word today is a bit more optimistic, but clearly there's a lot of powder in this keg.
There is a lot of powder in this keg, and civil war can't be ruled out entirely, because it is one thing to, you know, be in a hotel in Königswinter under a lot of pressure from diplomats, with a lot of people who are, you know, much more westernized. All the King's delegation, for instance, have lived in exile, and most of them have grown up in exile. On the ground, it's another matter. This is now quite a lawless place again.
Isabel Hilton, you've worked your way deep into this Pashtun community. Who are the Pashtun? What kind of world do the Pashtun live in if their word for cousin and enemy are the same?
Well, it's a pretty extraordinary world. I have to say the British had a long and rather bitter experience of the Pashtun, who they called Pathans, because they were at the northwestern fringe of the Raj, of the Indian part of the British Empire.
And brought British troops to grief again and again.
Absolutely, again and again. The British never managed to conquer the Pashtun, and they never managed to do the other thing that the British used to do with troublesome people on the fringes, which was buy out the leadership, because extraordinarily enough, the Pashtun are also very democratic. It's described as a society of regulated anarchy, if you like, but there is no single boss of any Pashtun tribe, and unless everybody agrees in a jirga, in a council, which operates at every level in Pashtun society, then nobody is bound by a rule. Once you've had a jirga, on the other hand, if you disobey the conclusions of the jirga, the punishment is unbelievable. Your house is burned down, you're banished, your property is given away, and if you ever defy the banishment and return to your territory, then you're shot. So it's a pretty good way of
fairly
enforcing
severe boundaries
will.
Here. I'm sorry, Isabel Hilton, but this is the jirga that people are talking about now, and the loya jirga that would be called to find the new way for the entire country.
Well, it's like the top level of the loya jirga. Mm-hmm. You can have a jirga to decide a marital dispute, or if somebody's, you know, cow eats your grass. You can have it for a family feud, which is constant family feuds in Pashtun tribal territory. And the loya jirga is the sort of national council, if you like. It's the supreme council of the Pashtun, traditionally only callable by the king. And it has been used in Afghanistan. It was used when the king still ruled Afghanistan. To approve new constitutions and so on. And at that level, it included not just the Pashtun, but the other ethnic groups. Some ethnic groups regard this as an instrument for the Pashtun to return to power. And certainly the Pashtun, who've been calling for a loya jirga for years to try to bring some order to Afghanistan, do see it as their instrument and the means of asserting what they regard as their historic right
their rightful
to rule
place.
Afghanistan.
And rightful now, even the Northern Alliance is now talking about moving toward a loya jirga. We're going to take a break soon, but Jack Beattie, I want to bring you in here before we go to that. The news out of Bonn today is hopeful, but Isabel Hilton reminds us that there's a lot of history here, and it's not simple, and we shouldn't expect an easy solution.
No, it's not. And the more I'm finding out about it, and I want to ask Isabel about it, is the role that Pakistan plays with the Pashtuns. And there was a hint in the report earlier that Pakistan sort of uses Pashtun nationalism as a club to you know, the irritant with the Northern Alliance. And that kind of meddling, we've been hearing a lot here about meddling from the other side of the border in Pakistan, refugees, Taliban slipping over the border. Well, I'm wondering now about the degree to which Pakistan is meddling itself through the Pashtun, for the Pashtun.
Isabel Hilton, 30 seconds, and then we've got to take a break.
Well, I have to say it's a little more complicated than that, because the Pashtun are divided between Afghanistan and Pakistan. There are roughly 20 million of them. 10 million of them live in Pakistan, and about 5 or 6 million in this unregulated tribal belt. So there's an open frontier. The Pakistani view that you can't do much in Afghanistan without the Pashtun is correct.
We'll come back and look more deeply into that. We're talking with Isabel Hilton this hour from London about the Pashtun. They're going to be key players one way or another in whatever is resolved in Afghanistan. Here's the question. Does the United States have the patience to see this thing through to stability? Will we ever get through to stability? Call us at 1-800-423-8255 or get into the conversation online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR, Boston.
From Boston University.
This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this evening with Isabel Hilton, author of a terrific article this week in New Yorker on the Pashtun Code, the Pashtun tribe, key players in Afghanistan, key to the possibility of peace and harmony going forward if they can come to some agreement with the Northern Alliance. Those talks going on in now Bonn, Germany right now. But the facts are being laid out on the ground. We're also joined by Jack Beattie, our news analyst, and we invite you as well. What do you think? Can we make this thing work out? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. Isabel Hilton, Jack Beattie was asking before the break about Pakistan's role here. Give us a quick geography lesson. Where do the Pashtun live? What's the terrain, the history? How does that all factor into their social and political identity? And are they Afghan or are they transnational?
Well, they call them, every Pashtun, I was told, calls himself an Afghan, though not every Pashtun is an Afghani. In other words, not all are citizens of Afghanistan, but they all call themselves Afghan. And indeed, other groups in Afghanistan call them Afghan too, regardless of where they live. Just to go back to Jack's point, I think for Pakistan the problem is that the Pashtuns' role in Afghanistan isn't just an external problem, it's an internal problem too, because of the fact that they straddle the border. When the British couldn't conquer or bribe the Pashtun, they decided to make a sort of cordon of them. They created the Northwest Frontier Province, and then they created an inner zone, which was a tribal zone, which nobody attempted to rule. They just negotiated with them from time to time. And that straddles the border, which is why Pakistan couldn't close the border during the war. And when all these tribesmen were marching off to the defense of their Pashtun brothers, the Taliban, the Pakistani government didn't actually want them to go, but they couldn't stop them any more than they could stop the refugees coming in. And they tried to stop them, but they just arrived in Peshawar and disappeared and went to stay with relatives. 160,000 people. This is a border which has historically carried everything from invading armies to drugs to contraband goods to people. And it's very difficult for Pakistan. It's mountainous terrain, it's wild passes. The tribal areas are areas that you don't travel at night in without an armed convoy. It really is wild country. Mm. You can't disarm the Pashtun either, though Musharraf has been trying, because the last time that Pakistan seriously meddled in Afghanistan was, of course, at the behest of the Reagan administration to fight the Russians, when Peshawar was the headquarters of the Holy War. Mm-hmm. And that left a residue of weaponry that you wouldn't believe.
You describe that in your article, sort of an understatement to say that they have weapons. Describe for us what you saw in the village of Dara Adam Kel.
Dara Adam Kel is a village of gunsmiths, and you know, they used to make flintlock rifles or whatever, but come the 80s, when all these Kalashnikovs and M16s were going around, they were very enterprising people, and on their little hand-driven, you know, lathes, and they turn out perfect copies for about $200-$300 of any automatic weapon you like. They were making rocket launchers, they were making landmines. I was told that they'd had a jirga about 6 years ago and decided not, you know, stop making armor piercing stuff, because of course it was all washing in to the tribal they were washing into the tribal disputes, and people were lobbing landmines at each other and firing at these fortified houses that they have with all sorts of heavy weaponry. So they've toned it down to things like Kalashnikov copies.
That's some cottage industry they have there.
It certainly is. And someone, an Afridi, who's a member of a major tribe, said, you know, there must be a Kalashnikov for every man, woman, and baby in Peshawar.
Well, talk to us about that culture. It's a frontier region and has been for a long time to almost every empire that's looked at it. But yet there is a code. You call it the Pashtun Code. What's that all about?
Pashtun Wali, yes, it is a very strict code, and it defines being Pashtun, if you like, and doing Pashtun. And the basic tenets of it are hospitality, sanctuary, and revenge. So that if somebody comes...
What a great combo.
Yes, it's a wonderful combination. But even if someone has killed your cousin, comes and asks you for sanctuary, you're obliged to give it to him. If somebody kills your guest, you're obliged to kill one of his. And it's just just, it's an extraordinary code, and it's absolutely rigidly adhered to. And it does play into the present situation, because, for instance, one of the things that distressed Pashtun would say about Osama bin Laden was, he's our guest. There's nothing, you can't ask him to leave.
Well, we all heard that, and we were flummoxed by that.
Well, indeed, but it's Pashtun Wali, and actually it's true. You can't be a Pashtun and ask a guest to leave. You can suggest to a guest that, you know, he might take it upon himself to leave, which is what they did. There was a jirga in Kandahar at one point of religious leaders who said to him, you know, perhaps you would like to consider, you know, moving on now. But if he refuses, there's nothing you can do under the Pashtun.
So that's the hospitality part, but you've also written about the central place of violence in Pashtun society.
It's an extraordinarily violent society, and this the enmity, the description of the Pashtun, the intimate parts of the Pashtun household, the woman's quarters, where children are brought up in this tribal code, it's quite extraordinary, and it is a struggle for survival. It's a struggle for power from infancy, and the saying that you quoted at the beginning of, you know, myself against my brother, my brother and I against our cousins. This is how life is lived, that you will struggle with your nearest and dearest to the death, unless somebody threatens the family from outside, at which point you will unite against them, and so on again, you know, until someone threatens the Pashtun as a whole, and then you tend to respond.
And you describe even domestic violence as a key part of this. So what do they say about a man who doesn't beat his wife?
A man who doesn't beat his wife is called a man with a small penis, I'm afraid. This is, women are observe strict pudor. This is not a female society. Though inside the women's quarters, they're extremely ferocious.
Jack Beatty, listening to this from Isabel Hilton, and then at the same time, as she points out, and we know in the gracious quarters of the hotel above Bonn, the diplomatic minuet goes on. The reports from there are optimistic, and of course Washington wants this to work out, but are we deluding ourselves here or not?
Well, you know, pessimism has taken a beating here in
sure
the last
has.
Few weeks. Expectations about the Northern Alliance and its military capacity have been overturned. Now we have expectations about the breakdown of the meeting in Bonn. Looked just the other day that was going to happen. Now not. I'm just getting the feeling that people are so desperate there for a new start that maybe there are political dynamics at work that can bridge some of these divisions. As I understand it, there's not as much inter-ethnic violence and antagonism as the tribal word might lead one to think, and that therefore there are political and security reasons for conflict. Well, that also says there may be political and security reasons for harmony, for getting together. I don't know. You know, I'm interested. Secretary Powell sort of has pledged the United States that women would have a much better role in the new Afghanistan. And yet you, Isabel, show a situation of, sort of systematic violence against women, different only in slight degree from the Taliban. Are you at all fearful that if the Pashtun have a big say in the government there, it'll be back to near Taliban conditions for women?
I don't think it will be as bad as that. And I think that there are distinctions among the Pashtun, for instance, between the Pashtun and the tribal belt in Pakistan, who have been left in a state of poverty and underdevelopment and lack of education for centuries, really. And the Pashtun, there's a world of difference between that and what was the court, or, for instance, of the former king. And the former king was a pioneer in terms of women's rights. He tried to remove the burqa. In fact, the royal ladies were seen without the veil at one point. This provoked a reaction. I mean, rather, as happened in Iran, there was a reaction to a perceived rapid modernization in the early 70s and late 60s. But there, again, you know, things have changed for so many Afghans. So many have lived abroad. But there was a time in Kabul where women wore dresses and went to medical school.
Yeah.
I see no reason why given a stable Afghanistan, given what they've been through, this couldn't come again. But it's just a little way off, I think.
Jack, Isabel, stand by. A lot of callers want to join our conversation. Let's bring them in. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Isabel Hilton about the Pashtun, the powerful, traditionally ruling tribe in Afghanistan, and how they will or will not make their way into a world suddenly controlled by the Northern Alliance. You can join the conversation. Bud is on the line right now. Welcome, Bud.
Hi. I'd like to ask just a really elementary question of geography.
Okay.
Every mountainous country that I know has two problems, trying to unify. And they need extremely strong leadership to unify, central leadership, something like Tito. And the other problem, and the other problem is, how do you get a functioning economy going that would support that, you know, that population that's so broadly spread? I just historically, it just blows my mind that you'd be able to have a country in such mountainous territory.
But interesting questions. Isabel Hilton, first, what's your experience with mountainous lands? Are they always difficult to govern? And secondly, maybe more importantly here, for all the development aid that's now promised, can you imagine a self-sustaining economy in this ruined mountainous desert country? Without opium, let's say.
Without opium. Ah, now you're qualifying it here.
Right. Had to make it harder for you just at the end.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, of course, there was a prosperous Afghanistan. In the days before the Kabul Museum was looted and sacked, it contained some of the most extraordinary treasures, which were testament to the fact that historically Afghanistan has been the locus of many magnificent civilizations and great prosperity. And although, yes, it's mountainous, And yes, it's in some places barren, but not by any means in all places. Mm-hmm. It's also astride some extremely important trade routes, which, you know, in a situation of peace and normality and thriving neighbors and an absence of war, bring prosperity too.
Not least of which maybe the oil pipeline that several companies would like to build across Afghanistan.
Well, indeed, that's a slightly contentious issue, but if it were to happen, then yes, of course that would bring benefits. I mean, I have to say that a lot of the trade that went through the Khyber Pass was contraband, but you know, again, it's trade, and there is no reason why it shouldn't be legitimized, given a stable region. As to unifying Afghanistan, I think that there is a tremendous will to unify Afghanistan. Historically, it's been a united country, modern Afghanistan, really, from the middle of the 18th century. And I think that everyone who is in Koenigswinter, whatever their suspicions of each other, whatever the doubts about the future, is there because they want to see a united Afghanistan.
We're at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking about the Pashtuns, who are going to have to be brought in to the post-Taliban government of Afghanistan, yet they were central to the Taliban itself. The United States is there and has got an interest in stability. How much harmony do we need to see in Afghanistan before we withdraw? 1-800-423-8255. Isabel Hilton, talk with us about Islam and the Pashtun relationship with it. Under the Taliban, it became a very fierce fundamentalist Islamic regime. Is that traditional, or where did it come from?
It's not traditional. I mean, they are traditionally an Islamic people, but it's a much more relaxed approach. The Taliban really came out of the 80s. They were largely refugees. They were already people whose tribal links were ruptured by war, by displacement, by exile. They came out of the refugee camps. They came under the influence of a particularly austere group of teachings which were called Diobandi. And the Diobandi began in India well over 100 years ago and were rather progressive when they began. But by the time they got to Pakistan in the 80s, they were an extremely fierce, rigid, dogmatic set of teachings, which were imparted in madrasas. Madrasas are religious schools. Mm-hmm. And the religious schools blossomed all over Pakistan in the middle of the Holy War. They were part of the Holy War. The decision to fight the Russians on the basis of Islam instead of on the basis of Afghan nationalism, which was a choice that was made, mm-hmm. meant that there was a huge boost given to fundamentalist Islamic ideas, which at the time were seen as benign because they were anti-communist and, of course, turned into this monstrous thing which we all now regret. But in a way, the genie was out of the bottle. There were thousands of madrasas imparting very little in the way of any kind of useful secular education, but to very poor children. They were very rich, and they educated children for nothing, boys, of course. Mm-hmm. They gave them food, they gave them accommodation, and they taught them that it was a good thing to die for Islam. Some of them went off and became maulanas or mullahs themselves, but others formed the core of the Taliban. The word Taliban means religious scholar. Mm-hmm. It's a plural of talib. It means people who studied in these madrasas. So you have these people who'd lost their social connection, if you like, and became much, much more extreme than the more rooted society, albeit a wild society that I've been describing. But that is a society which has its own code and it has its own loyalties. The Taliban had no other loyalty.
Do you see the Pashtun being successful at pulling away from the Taliban now? Is there a full identity for them to retreat into? Can they let go of
yes.
all that?
I think that there are sort of multiple identities for the Pashtun. And whilst many young Pashtun did come under the Taliban influence, it's quite difficult to tease out whether they were being loyal to them or they felt that attachment to them because they were Pashtun and they were moreover Durrani, which is the right kind of Pashtun to rule Afghanistan. They had brought order, after all, to Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. One forgets that now. But Afghanistan, after the Russians left, had 6 years of appalling mayhem, when really women had a bad time under the Taliban, but they really weren't safe at all in the civil war. And so they were, to some extent, welcomed, certainly initially. People said to me over and over again, in refugee camps, I welcomed the Taliban when they arrived because they put in order. And then, of course, the cruelty started. But we should remember that. And so there was a sort of loyalty operating there on two levels. One was the appeal of this very absolutist Islamic code, which I think is separable, certainly, from Pashtun identity.
Jack Beattie, maybe there's an opportunity here. If the U.S. and multinational forces can bring order, maybe that order can attract the same kind of appreciation in Afghanistan that the Taliban initially did.
Well, let's hope. I'm just curious in asking Isabel. I mean, you talk about the 48 refugee camps in the Northwest Frontier Province with 2 million refugees. To what extent are the forces that brought about the Taliban, the despair, the people without their tribes, the only kind of education through this austere religious? To what extent are those same things still alive in those camps?
Isabel, hold the thought. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back for the answer to that question. We're talking about the Pashtun tribe and the role they'll play in the new Afghanistan. We're at 1-800-423-8255 with Isabel Hilton. We're winning on the military front, but can we create a stable Afghanistan? Join the conversation. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the Afghanistan's Pashtun tribe and the role they will or will not play in the new Afghanistan with Isabel Hilton, a writer in London who's recently been in the area and written in depth about the Pashtuns in this week's New Yorker magazine, and with our own news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Isabel, just before the break, Jack Beattie was asking about the many Pashtun refugee camps in Pakistan, the schools there, the madrasas that are often fundamentalist Islamic schools and hotbeds of anti-American teaching. We saw on the news just recently, Pakistan has agreed generally to try and crack down on some of these madrasas. Do you see that kind of teaching and inculcation being reversed?
Well, I think Pakistan has woken up rather late in the day to the dangers of this kind of thing. I mean, this is a problem for Pakistan itself, because Pakistan came into existence in very violent and difficult circumstances with partition from India. And it's a country itself divided between rival ethnic groups without a common identity. And it came into being because of Islam, because they were Muslims and they didn't want, for the most part, to belong to a Hindu-dominated mm-hmm. independent India. So that was the sort of founding thought of Pakistan, but it never really served as a unifying ideology because there were too many differences between the Muslims themselves. There were different groups, there were different teachings, there were all kinds of difficulties in the way of turning Pakistan into a sort of full-blown Islamic state. And that really didn't change until Zia al-Haq, who was the general in charge when the war against the Russians began. Mm-hmm. And that was also the stepping up of the Islamization of Pakistan was another function of that time, of the 80s, which has left us this very difficult legacy. And in that 20 years since the 80s, it got into all walks of life, not just in the army, where there are many fundamentalists, mm-hmm. but also in the civil service, in the universities, because people with those ideas were promoted and people who opposed them were not. And many people who opposed them, the secular liberal figures, lost their jobs, let alone people who were leftist, you know, who had to leave the country. So there's a whole spectrum of opinion that is very underrepresented, which now Musharraf is trying to encourage. He's actually talking to these people, which is unusual for a military leader, but he is an unusual military leader. Mm-hmm. And he has recognized that this is a dangerous thing. And he's warming up for a confrontation with them. He's trying to turn the madrasas into something much more closely resembling regular schools, for instance. Mm-hmm. The problem there is that education in Pakistan has been so shamefully neglected for so long.
Fundamentally.
Absolutely, fundamentally neglected. That you know, you have to build up a secular education.
Right, there's not much to turn to
things.
If you move away
exactly.
from it. Isabel Hilton, stand by. Let's bring our callers in. A lot would like to join the conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Sarwar is on the line. Welcome, Sarwar.
Hi.
Good evening.
Good evening to you. I have a comment. In Afghanistan, we don't have a majority. In fact, Afghanistan is a nation of minorities. So putting much emphasis on Pashtun may broaden the gap between Afghan ethnic groups.
Are you Afghan, Sarwar?
Yes.
And so you're saying perhaps this gives too much weight to the Pashtun faction.
Yeah, and I also have a comment regarding Pashtunwali or Pashtun Kurds.
Yes.
As you are talking, I think let's not phrase the Pashtunwali, because this Pashtunwali is a kind of tradition which are to a great extent the barriers to development and mm-hmm. Participation.
Mm-hmm. So, hang on, let us put those to Isabel Hilton. First, we should bear in mind that Afghanistan has many groups, not only Pashtun. So how do we assess their importance in what goes forward? And then Sarwar is saying, let's not aggrandize this code. It's a real throwback problem.
Well, to take the second one first, there are many Pashtun who feel that. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned before, the tribal groups have been left in a condition of poverty and underdevelopment, to some extent deliberately, because Pashtun nationalism was a threat to Pakistan also. And mm-hmm. if they couldn't reach an accommodation with these people, they tended just to try and sort of leave them in their land, but really did very little for them. There are Pashtun leaders who want development, who want secularization, who want modernization. The tide of history in Pakistan in the last 20 years has been very much against them. But again, they're beginning to find a voice. So the future for the tribal belt may be very different. And of course, as a society develops, then this way of living does fall away. I've met Pashtun women who've abandoned the veil, who want to mm-hmm. challenge those traditional traditional beliefs. And certainly all these currents exist. As far as Afghanistan is concerned, it's absolutely true there is no majority. Pashtun, nevertheless, are the largest minority. And In terms of how you weigh that in the future of Afghanistan, I guess what I'm saying is that you have to listen to how they perceive themselves and how they perceive their role. Because although it may be an unwelcome thought, it is nevertheless true that if they are not on board, then no solution is going to work. So to that extent, I'm afraid that, distasteful though their view of their historical role may be to many, it has to be taken into account.
Let's take another caller. Jeff is on the line. Welcome, Jeff. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I want to compliment all of you on the level of conversation that you've been having and bringing this information to the public.
Thanks, Jeff.
I have a very quick comment and then a question. The comment is that as guests, it's usual to bring gifts. And I would think that one of the best things that we could do as pseudo-guests would be to bring all of our resources to Afghanistan and help them build up the country in the kind of context which exists there, the anarchic, political, at the best level, context that exists there, and do what we can on their terms to just increase the general level of viability for everybody there.
I guess we're guests in B-52s right now, but we take your point.
I'm just putting it in a phrase, because I think that we could be welcome guests if we were to do that and to bring them, to bring people there, helpful resources.
Let's put that, our time's running down, Jeff, and I apologize, but I want to get that to Isabel Hilton. Do you think that the international community can bring the resources here that will grease the way for the kind of a reunification of these tribes after so many years of fighting and civil war?
Well, people are longing for it. Jack's question about the refugee camps, there are people there who've been refugees for 20 years. There are people there who arrived 3 weeks ago. They're all desperate for an end to war. They're all desperate for a normal life. They want to go back to their farms, their houses, their jobs. They want to rebuild their country. They really long for peace. And I think that anything that can be done to help them, and I think it will need a lot, but anything that can be done to help them, they have more than earned.
I wanted to ask you, you were there just in October, not long ago at all, and at that time, as you write, no one imagined that the Taliban would lose, let alone appear to lose so quickly. What do people make of that now? You know, everyone, as here, people were talking about, oh, the British couldn't do it, the Russians couldn't do it, the Americans will be stuck in the swamp, and here we are, just weeks later. How do you think that's being received, perceived by the Pashtun, among others?
I think they were pretty stunned, actually. With the speed of it, that week in which, on the Saturday nothing was moving, and by the following Saturday they were in retreat towards the south. There are, however, some diehards in Pakistan who believe still that this is a brilliantly managed strategic retreat in order the better to fight the guerrilla war.
Well, that's a very dramatic retreat indeed, then.
Indeed it is, yes. With a pinch of salt, that one, I think.
Isabel Hilton, our time is running down, but we want to thank you for joining us this evening.
It's been a real pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Isabel Hilton is a foreign correspondent for radio, TV, and newspapers. Her article, The Pashtun Code, is featured in this week's New Yorker magazine. Jack Beatty there, the Pashtuns on a platter from Isabel Hilton for us, and apparently progress in Bonn. Maybe, as you say, the level of exhaustion is just getting all these factions ready to do something new.
Yes, that plus the prospect of a carrot, a huge reconstruction aid, if that can be carried through. I mean, we abandoned, the West did, these people after the Soviets left. That was our only interest there, using them as a means to get the Soviets out. And so we owed them from a long time back. And I really sense perhaps this may have been, in a strange way, September 11th may turn out to have been a fortuitous date in Afghan history, if it can bring about the possibilities that seem to be on the table here.
What a mind-bending thought, the September 11th tragedy here and a kind of lancing of the boil there.
Yeah, an American writer who lives in the Bowery complained that we don't have our cinema back here yet, but people in Kabul are going to the cinema. So
it ain't fair.
No.
Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, for a map illustrating the ethnic divisions of Afghanistan, go to our website at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. Now, Afghans living around the world are watching the meeting in Bonn with great interest. One Afghan living in America is hoping the meeting will lay the groundwork for a government that represents the interests of all of Afghanistan's tribes. As a member of the Hazara tribe, he worries that a Pashtun-dominated government might continue to exclude his people from Afghan politics and that missteps in Bonn might condemn the troubled country to continued division.
My name is Ubaid Nijadi. Currently, I'm at Harvard, Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Studies. And I'm from Afghanistan, but of a Hazara origin. And Hazaras are the third largest ethnic group in Afghanistan after the Pashtuns and the Uzbeks. I came to the United States in 1993 along with my family. But before that, we were living in Pakistan. And Pakistan was the host country to a large Afghan refugee population, but the majority of those refugees were of Pashtun's ethnic background. And because of the traditional policies of the Pakistani government favoring the Pashtun ethnic group over the others and trying to use the Pashtuns to advance the strategic goals in the region, they had put a lot of constraints on the non-Pashtun Afghan refugees in general and on the Hazaras in particular. So the situation became very inhospitable for us to continue living there. There were direct threats to our lives, the lives of my family. So we had no choice but to leave Pakistan and seek asylum in the United States. I'm still in touch with what's going on in Afghanistan and have much interest for the Afghan peace process in general, but for my people, the Hazaras in particular. Because historically, Hazaras have been heavily persecuted, discriminated against by the successive Pashtun governments for the last 250 years. We were denied a lot of opportunities and a lot of things that were offered to the Pashtuns and to other ethnic groups. So when I came to the United States, and as a person, regardless of my ethnic background, everything was based on my performance and on my achievements as a person. So that kind of made me realize the virtue of the system that is established in the United States. And that kind of brought this hope in my mind that we will have something in Afghanistan, something close to what we have in the United States. The main goal should be to achieve not any type of peace, but a just peace. Just the absence of war should not be the goal, but the goal and the primary concern should be to have ethnic justice established in Afghanistan. So the root of the conflict will be addressed and the root of the conflict would be taken care of. So I would definitely love to see someday that I would be able to use what I've learned here and the expertise that I've gained and the experiences that I've acquired to be able to use those, apply those to the benefit of my country, Afghanistan, and to the benefit of my people, the Hazaras, and to be able to contribute to the establishment of ethnic justice in Afghanistan.
Ubaid Nijati lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We'd like to hear from you. Email us your submissions for future radio diaries. The address is special@wbur.org.